Tonight on the show, it is always an honor and a privilege to be able to interview one of my heroes. This woman is really inspirational to me. I had no idea she was actually in recovery till I saw an interview with her on Podcasting After Dark. Shout out to Corey. Shout out to Zach. But listening to that, I loved her even more. She is one of the stars of one of my favorite movies, The All-Nighter, and also one of the stars of Vamp, as well as the TV series Big Sky, and tons of other stuff as well. She's awesome. She's fun. She's funny. And her name is Dee Dee Pfeiffer. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Erin. Wow, what an intro. I got to tell you, that's better than a shot of espresso right
Right.
there. Wait a minute. Thank you so much. Nothing wrong with a little flattery first thing in the morning.
Absolutely. Oh no, absolutely. I like I said, man, I've been a fan since the All-Nighter. I saw that as a kid, and my little sister and I used to watch it insanely, like all the time. And I gotta show this to you so you know that I am a true fan.
Oh, I got to put my glasses on for this girl.
I have the soundtrack
Okay,
on CD because
well,
I'm
I'm
four.
just gonna say, are you holding a CD?
I am because I'm 45 and I still listen to CDs.
Honey, I'm 61 and I have to explain to my boys what a freaking remote or a rotary telephone is. They're like, oh, those are funny. I'm like, no, it's
I
not.
know. The worst day of my life is going to be when I buy a new car and it's like, oh, CD players do not exist anymore, Aaron. And I will be like, oh, tear, you know, so.
Now we use those to clip in the phone holder.
Yeah, oh, the whole thing, right? So, I'm a huge fan of yours. And then, like I said, I heard you on Podcasting After Dark, and I was like, oh shit, she's in recovery. She's a recovery warrior also. So I had to have you on the show. So
Thank
welcome.
you. Well, when I first got on this morning, we talked about it, and I'd asked you how long you had, and you said 17 years, and I've got 7 years. Or is it 6 years? Oh my God, girl, I can't remember how old I am.
I know it's hard. Sometimes it is hard because it's like I was like, okay, I'll be 17 in November. So in the technical sense, and no fronts, no pass, right? But yeah, so I have like 16 years, and yeah, sometimes I have to do the math on it. I'm like, I got clean in 08.
Really?
Da da da.
But how about this? If you're out there and you have 1 hour,
Oh, I
you're
know
fucking
exactly.
in my book, okay? Because
Fuck
the
yeah.
they say 1 day at a time. No, it's 1 minute at a time most days, especially now in the climate of what's going on, which I won't get into, but I mean, you have to
If you've
really
ever listened to the
be
show,
under, unless you know that. I mean, look at, I mean, you can't see this video, you can only hear it, but behind my head on my wall, I have a peace sign, which they always say what's one person's trash is another person's treasure. Someone was throwing that away many years ago. I happened to walking by and I went, oh hell no, you don't throw a peace sign away that's made out of wicker, right? So I grabbed that and I've been carrying it around for years, and I just the other day hung it and I needed a ladder. When I got down, I looked, and of course it's crooked. It's I don't know how to say that. It's not centered. And I went, oh, do I go up there, get the ladder out again, go up there and fix that? Or do I leave it like that as a reminder that that's kind of how everybody, not just people in the United States, but everybody in the world, and throw in anybody in recovery or active in their disease of addiction, that's kind of what's going on. That's the epitome of it, is a lopsided peace sign, right? We are trying to be balanced. We are trying to have peace. We are trying in this world right now to get it together. And it's really difficult. But then you throw in, I'm choosing not to have a cigarette. I'm choosing not to have a bottle of wine. I'm choosing not to have heroin. I'm choosing not to have sex or whatever, your addiction is, right? It's really challenging to, so to say we're survivors is an understatement. And I was saying that you have 17 years. Damn, people would say, oh, well, she's got this. And I said, right?
No, because like it's funny because in the beginning, you always hear it's like, keep coming back, right? And it's keep coming back to the meetings, keep coming back to your sobriety, keep coming back here, right? But then in like second stage recovery, like after a certain time, it's continuously keep coming back to the principles, right? It's keep coming back to the steps. And that's the hard stuff, right? It's not the, the going to meetings. easy, right? Doing the fellowshipping thing, great, sponsorship. But having, when in the deep dark night, when I'm not in a meeting and I'm not in the public eye, so to speak, being able to be like, ooh, that's not a good decision for my recovery or my relationship or my feelings of self-esteem as a woman, right? So, yeah, dude, it's like, it's a
Well,
consistent
we're
thing.
saying that you have to treat, whether it's 1 hour or 1 day or 1 week or 1 month or 17 years or 30 years, whatever, however much time you have, to me, you have to treat it like it's a baby. It's that vulnerable. And that's what we were talking about. You have 17 years. Oh, you got it. It's like, oh, hold on. They would seem like that from the outside, but everybody is vulnerable to what the one would say, going out, hiccup, relapse, whatever you want to call it. I don't know what you name it. Bottom line is, to me, the bottom line in that possibility is fear. Everything in life comes down to fear. And I'm going to
Absolutely.
tell you, my getting my ass sober reminded me that fear was driving me on every freaking thing with them.
Everything.
Yeah.
Everything. Fear of financial, fear of financial insecurity, fear of the relationship, fear of the, yeah.
Right, girl? And this is where I'm going to go a little deeper with my sobriety. I was just having a conversation with myself as I'm brushing my teeth. This is what I do because I'm the only one in my house that listens to me. One of my teenagers just moved out to go to college. The other one's still here. And trust me, he knows more than me. I promise you. Or that's what I let him to believe. But he is really smart. But the thing is that I thought to myself, wow, what I keep trying to do every day with my sobriety is not just keep sober. It has to mean more to that. It's even more fragile and vulnerable if it's only about staying sober every day. That's a very linear way to look at sobriety. And by the way, I throw this out to anybody who's not sober or who doesn't have an addiction. How about look at your life? Are you 100% happy with your life most days? Do you feel like you're in a rut? Are you doing the same thing day in and day out? Do you kind of feel like you need to be elevated to another frequency, another level of enlightenment, maybe? And now often people can find this through religion. Great. If you can find a religion, you go. And if not, for those of us who are not religious, and yeah, I did AA and I wasn't religious and I'm still not, but I'm very spiritual.
Yes,
You
girl.
gotta get me going. Spirituality goes way back thousands and thousands and millions of years. That shit goes way back. And so to me, that has roots. If you have a soul that's connected to spirituality, you can be spiritual and religious. They're two different things.
Oh,
I'm embarrassed
totally.
not people's religion. And of course, unless your religion says go kill people, I got a problem with that. But I have a problem with anybody killing people, period, whether you're religious or not. How about just stop that? Okay with me in my book. I'm not going to judge you. I'm just not going to join your team of hate and
Yeah.
negativity, and you are less than me, so you need to be hurt or alienated. You know what I mean? Or, no. I'm not on team ugly, team hate. I'm on team love, light, and let's get this shit together, even though my peace sign is lopsided. Hey, I swear to you, it's still a it is so. For me, and what I would love to give to people is that especially if you're stuck in your sobriety and say the steps aren't doing it anymore, the meetings aren't doing anymore, and you get to a place, because it is a stepping. I did AA every day for a year straight. And I'm not joking, I did not miss a day. Some days I went twice a day, and some days it was so bad I went three times a day
I remember that.
for 1 whole year.
Yep. It's like you did a more than a 90 and 90. You did like a 365 and 365.
Steroids, because I was that pigheaded, I was that determined, and I was that still confused as to what the hell was going on and this change that was happening. And I was afraid of it, because what was happening is, as you peel the onion of all of the societal crap that's laid on us as human beings from children on, you got to unpeel that, because what's deep down inside all of us is the authentic self. Is the authentic self that doesn't have disease, that doesn't have hate, that doesn't have any of that crap. The authentic self is love and light. That's what we all are. But it's all covered up with all these layers of just layers and layers of onion. And if you've ever peeled an onion, it's not pretty. But guess what? Wear sunglasses if you got it. Wear goggles. Wear gloves. Plug your nose. But peel that fucking onion, because what's deep down inside is this person that has the right to be here in this body in this lifetime. and you want to be on team love and light. You want to be on team, I'm more than what I say, I do. It's what I do, not what I say. And then that comes in, there's your enlightenment, there's your spirituality or religion, whatever, right? And so if you're stuck, go deeper, right? Stop looking at life like it's linear. Like what you see is not all it.
There's so much more to it.
Oh, you bet. So that word curiosity is thrown around a lot, but it's not really harped on. Curiosity does not kill the cat. Whoever in the hell made that up needs to be slapped.
No, because curiosity is where the growth comes from.
There you go. But you know, when you say curiosity killed the cat, that's keeping you submissive. That's keeping you in place. That's keeping that fear around you, that onion layered, so you can't get to the real self of like, who am I? Why am I here? And then what happens? It's no longer about your sobriety. It's about what's your purpose in life, man? Why are you here? I can tell you one thing. You're not here to stay drunk or fucked up on meth or doing whatever your DOC drug of choice is to a point where it clouds who you are. It's not that. Because getting sober or leaning into your addiction is a rebirth, man. It is a rebirth. It's a recharge. It's a reset on the computer. It's a program like get rid of the old memory and put in a new one fresh. That's what that is. And you don't have to get sober to have that. People have these epiphanies all the time, right?
Yeah. And I mean, like we've said, like anyone can benefit from the basic tenets of recovery, right? Like anyone can benefit from honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. Anyone can benefit from acceptance, right? Or curiosity or growth or any of those things. It's just, I think that, yeah, I think people, I don't necessarily think people are happy in their discomfort. I think they're just familiar. And I think that that's the biggest problem is people don't want the unfamiliar. They get scared of the unfamiliar. And
The
yeah.
word scared of the
Yeah.
unfamiliar, scared of getting out of our comfort zone. Think about it. The world is designed to make it easier, and we're more like easier, 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 easier. Everything has to be easier, faster, more, easier, faster, more. And we've gotten super far away from what it really means to be connected to Mother Earth. Because I am sorry. Tell me one thing that's bigger, badder, or more powerful, other than one's God, than Mother Earth, right? Mother Earth happens to be my higher power, if you haven't noticed. The bitch ain't playing. I am sorry. And we are messing with her pretty bad.
Oh, God.
Here's the beauty. Mankind may or may not make it and destroy everything that's beautiful in the process, but Mother Earth is still going to be here because she's that amazing. So why would we want to ruin the very thing that gives us life? But so, like, for me, like, even just shifting into like somebody who is being mindful of my carbon footprint, meaning I try every day to be mindful of it. Am I 100% successful? No, but I'm mindful of it and I try. You know what I mean? It's not about being 100%. It's just about shifting the way we think about why we're here. Also, if you don't know what your purpose in life is, if you don't know why you're waking up every morning, it's hard to wake up if you don't know what your purpose is. You know how you find your purpose? Find your passion. Discover your passion, and your passion will always lead you to your purpose. And there, life gets elevated. And then your soul has a purpose in this body, in this lifetime. Now, you notice I didn't even mention recovery in that.
Right, exactly.
That is one of the many doors that opens that we don't really talk about enough, I think, in recovery is go a little lever higher in frequency, man, right?
Yeah.
Go. It's scary, but guess what? There's a lot of things that are scary. But if you can get sober or lean into your addiction, damn, you're already a tough. You're already tough, man. Let's go. And those who are not dealing with that, you're tough because you're listening to us right now and you're interested. We're planting the seed. We're gonna, right, girl? We're gonna plant the seed and run. Plant
Yeah, right. I know they always say it. Lay
the
the
seed and run.
kit of spiritual tools at someone's feet and then walk the fuck away because you cannot
Plant it and run.
control if they pick it up.
People say, why doesn't he, she, they get sober? They have so much to live for. I say, because they're not ready.
Right. You have to be ready. You have to do it for yourself. It is not something that can be done for your family because it's not something that can be done for your partner. Nope.
And there's a thing called staying in your own lane. That's a hard one. What we've discovered, you want to share that with everybody, and you want them to feel what we felt, that you want them to experience what we're experiencing. Well, guess what? Everybody has their own journey in this lifetime, in these earth bodies at this time. And that's a big lesson for me to learn. Because I want everyone to be happy. I want everyone to stop hurting Mother Earth, animals, and each other. I really, really, really do. And it's very hard for me to be a sober empath to see what's going on and not really get kicked in the face.
Thank you, because I'm an empath also. I'm a Pisces, so we're all empaths, right? But but I'm the same way, and everything is in my heart. Everything is on my soul, you know?
I love the way you just took your hand and you pushed it towards your heart. And that's what you're doing right now as an empath. You're taking it into your heart. Now, we both know as light workers, energy workers, that is when I have to turn that energy back out and say, hold on, I'm going to stop and do some kind of energy work, whether it's meditation or prayer or just my thoughts into those being hurt right now and say, I love you. I love you. I send you love. I send you light. And for those who are spreading hate, evil, and destruction and harming others, I leave space for you. I leave, now that's a hot, I didn't say I accept it. I'm not,
Right.
and people say you have to love everybody. You know, I'm not sure if that, good luck with that. You're a bigger person than I am. I don't love them. I hate what they're doing. Oh, I absolutely despise what they're doing, but I don't hate them. They are so misdirected, and I think they got some dark in their DNA. There's something going on with the soul that I don't know what that is. I don't judge it, but I leave space for it. And that space that I leave for those who are doing that space is not in front of me. It's over to the side. And then I leave more space for those people like you who are light workers. People I find that, you know, there's just these people who are going out of their way to help other people out of nowhere. And people are videotaping it and putting it on Instagram. And then we get to see that and say, okay, people actually haven't given up on each other. There's random acts of kindness and love are still out there. And my God, if you don't know that, you better watch your other algorithms or whatever the hell you call it. Careful who you
Yes. No,
on
you're right. No,
your
but you're right. It's like
yes.
we can cultivate that happiness. We can cultivate that peace, right? It's like we are the architects of our own misery or our own joy, right? So
Law of attraction right
yeah,
there.
so we can totally do it.
They say,
So
real quick, they say if you want to know the world, if you want to confirm the world is shit, read the news or see the news. If you
right.
want to confirm that the world is actually beautiful, go out in nature.
Yes, absolutely. I
And
completely
both
agree.
exist at the same fucking time.
I
There
love
we
that.
go,
That's
right?
so cool. Okay. First of all, how did you get into acting? I know you did. I know you were in Into the Night, and then obviously Vamp was up, you know, and then we have, you know, the all-nighter and all that good stuff. But like, what made you decide personally in your life journey to just become an actress?
Well, I apologize for those who are listening to this again who've already heard me interview because I'm gonna tell the same story.
I don't care.
My history hasn't changed. I wish I could tell a different story, but it's my truth. So here we go. But I'll try to make it a little more interesting than the last 50 times I've answered this question. Not that your question is, but people who've never heard me are like, hey, how did she get started? Well, it goes to show you never freaking know, okay? Because I was moseying on doing my own thing as a teenage as a young girl in Orange County, not the rich Orange County, but the more towards Garbage Grove. And if those people who know Garden Grove and Garbage, you know, I live down there. I'm 61. So do the math. I was born in 64. It was a whole different place down there, you know. So do the math there. For young kids, sorry, you probably would never know, but there were orange groves in Orange County. And my dad even bought a plane up north for like $50 and rehabbed it and flew the little plane over our house and landed it like in our backyard.
Wow.
That's what Orange County to be, and now it's totally different. So my sister Shell, yes, Michelle Pfeiffer is my sister, and she got into it the way she did. So I was this young girl in, I don't know, middle, younger than middle, junior high, whatever, really young, watching my sister, you know, be an actress, and that had to have been the coolest thing ever, and still is if you really want to go there. And so I went on working many, many jobs. I was a delivery when I could drive. I was a delivering radiators to and from a radiator company,
Wow.
picking radiators at gas stations and bring them to the Westminster Radiator Company. That's right. It was a guy's job. They hated me. Anyway, but it was good money. I always did things for the money. I didn't really care about how they treated me, but which hence that goes into a whole nother rabbit hole.
I was gonna say, yeah, that's a whole other podcast topic right here.
Well, then we're going to go into trauma. So, I danced in the Disneyland parade. I used to make dried floral arrangements in the 70s because those were cool. I used to go down the street and scraped dental impressions for a girl who used to make the dental impressions that an orthodontist makes for kids with braces. They used
Yes.
to send them to this girl, this woman, and she had a plaster maker in her kitchen and the whole thing. And Kelly Finoglio and I used to go and rinse them off and make plasters of them. And we would do that for probably like a dollar a day or something. I counted spoons, put them in a box with another neighbor. I've had 1,000 jobs, like, boxer at a grocery store. Oh my God. So what happened, by the time I was 18, I was like, my God, what am I going to do now? My sister had been doing Scarface at the time. So she had been elevated at that point. And I said, well, I need to move out. What am I going to do? So I said, hey, Sal, that's what I call her. I think I want to be an actor. And she goes, oh, well, okay. First thing you do is do not think about an agent. Do not think about headshots. Get your ass into an acting workshop. So I took my stuffed monkey and the few things I had in my 66 Volkswagen, drove from Orange County up to LA and lived in her office on the couch with my stuff in the corner, with my monkey on top. And I got a job as illegally cocktailing at a female oil and mud wrestling place called Hollywood Tropicana at the time.
Oh, that's so cool. Okay.
Well, cool is one word for it, yes.
I would also say wildly inappropriate and problematic, but
Let's see, it was 1982.
okay, so you're 18 and
Yeah.
82. Got it. Okay.
Hold on, I was 20. So it was 84 because
Okay.
I was just a year under 21 to legally work there. I just kept
Oh.
saying, Alberto, I'll bring my license tomorrow. This was back in the day when nobody carded anybody. We were partying at Seven Seas, Odyssey, all these Hollywood clubs. From Orange County, we'd come up at night, we'd sneak out and come up to LA and dance all night and then sneak back, drive all the way back down an hour down south, sneak back into the house at 16 years old. And they never asked for ID. We were doing all sorts of shit back then. Never get away with that now. So anyways, so I was working and doing that. The reason why I worked that job, not because it was sexy, God knows, but it helped me pay for very expensive acting classes, which I did for over a year, actually. I was horrible. I stuttered. I couldn't remember my lines. I was like, I know Peggy Feury, who was at that time the number one coach of everybody at the time. And I know her and her husband, Bill Traylor, had to have been looking at me going, why is this girl in this class? Why
Oh.
does she think she can be an actor? And the worst part is my sister had studied with them as well, who was brilliant. And I was just so bad. But I don't know what the hell is wrong with me. I think it's because I conquered every job that I had done since I was like 12. I kind of mastered and got bored with it. I couldn't master this. I was not good. I was just horrible. So because my mom used to call me a hard head, I kept going and going and going. And finally, after a year, I don't know what made me think that I was ready to audition, but I went and got an agent and headshots, and I auditioned and was really bad. We didn't have cell phones back then or email or anything like that. So they would have to call the agents and tell them, wow, your client sucks or whatever. Don't have her come back in again. Or, yeah, we like her, have her do a callback. So I think because I was Michelle's sister, my agent kept me on. And I eventually actually gave a good interview and I got a job. Shell at that point was doing Into the Night with John Landis and Jeff Goldblum. And long story short, I got this role. I went home. My family, nobody was more excited than the Pfeiffer family when Dee Dee got a freaking job. Talk about, oh, hold on, we're back. Hi, honey, what are you doing? It's my dog. Okay. Hi.
Oh,
She is, she's,
he's a floofer. She.
she's
He's a
a,
floofer.
yeah, she's a fluffer. She's a great Pyrenees.
Oh,
No, actually, that's a Bernese Mountain Dog. I love those. This is a great Pyrenees.
Great Pyrenees is the one that was on. Okay, so this is I'm dating myself at this point, but back in Nickelodeon was a TV station.
I
They
remember.
used to have this cartoon called Belle and Sebastian, and Belle was a Pyrenees. It was a totally white dog, and Sebastian was this little tiny kid who was looking for his mother named Isabel in the mountains of Spain, and the dog accompanied him everywhere, and it was Belle and Sebastian. I have not laid eyes on that cartoon since I was probably 4 or 5,
That's great. They have the dew clots, so cool.
but it was one of those dogs where it was just such a majestic dog, right? So I had never seen him, like, in the wild, right? So
A livestock guardian dog, and they're phenomenal what they do just to protect their herd. And she
oh.
thinks we are her herd. So she went out there right now to yell at the squirrels and the chipmunks.
Oh, how wonderful.
And there she is again. Yeah, you tell those chipmunks that how dare them get near us. Okay, here we go, girl. There. So he's gonna stay out there with her.
That's okay.
So anyways, I got the role. There was a thing called a SAG card.
Oh, SAG card. Yes. I
That
guess if you'd like to explain to the audience, I'm acting like everyone freaking knows, but yeah.
union, like anything else, right? It's a Screen Actors Union. And to work in any union project at that time, everything was union. Everything on TV and all feature films were union. You had to be in the Screen Actors Union to do these projects, right? So we didn't really have that. I remember independent films or anything like that where you didn't have to be in the union unless you just backyard video, which didn't go anywhere. Remember, because we didn't have computers back then. So, anyways, there were actors that were union who had somehow wiggled their way in and got a SAG card, and others like me who still hadn't worked on a union project to earn the card yet. You had to earn it. You had to have a certain amount of hours and money and da da da. So I was still like trying to get that job. So I got the union job. My agents had forgotten that I was one of the clients that didn't have it. So when they called to say, okay, Dee Dee's union, they said, no, she's not. They called my agents back and said, sorry, we're going to take the other girl that we like just as much as Dee Dee because she's union in the union, Dee Dee's not. They called me back and said they took the role from you. Well, Shell went to work that night on Into the Night with John Landis, and she told John that story, and John was like livid. He's like, that's bullshit. She earned that role. It doesn't cost that much money to Taft Hartley her into the union. That's bullshit. She earned it. So he goes, tell her to come to Fredericks of Hollywood Friday night, 10 p.m., wear her trashiest clothes, look as 10 like a $10 hooker. I'll throw her in front of the camera, give her a couple lines, and we'll get her SAG card. But it won't land in the film, but I'll give her SAG card. So Shell came home and told me. I was like, whoa, that was easy. So I literally went looking like the way I look when I went dancing in clubs, which I guess is pretty trashy, like a $10 hooker. So I went in front of the camera. He looked at me and said, look at your sister and say, hey, you want to party, and then look at Jeff Goldblum and said, you want a date, and then they're going to react and then get off camera, and then I'm going to cut it out, but you'll have your SAG card. I said, okay, great. So I did it. I was studying at that point for 2 years. So those two lines, I gave it my 1,000%. He loved what I did so much, he kept it in the movie, and he also gave me extra ADR, which is audio dialogue replacement work, to pay for the SAG card because I didn't have enough money to pay for it. John Landis and my sister are responsible for me starting, and from there I was able to audition for legally audition for and then my career took off from there. But it was talk about somebody just stepping in and saying this system is wrong, right? A lot of systems just are broken and are wrong, you know.
Oh, I see. So when you went to do Vamp, which is in 85, I've heard that that was kind of a difficult shoot for a lot of people, just like on a physical level. So if you want to talk about that.
There's quite a few things out there called like the making of Vamp. There was movies and like clips and stuff, the making of Vamp, and you can go research it. I've done a lot of interviews for people who have made like documentaries or whatever of the making of Vamp, because it was the movie was the making of Vamp. was nothing short of a miracle. Richard Wank, who is a producer, director, and writer, a phenomenal. And down to the casting of Grace, the casting of me, and we had, oh my God, I mean, where do I begin? We were working nights downtown Los Angeles. My car got stolen off the set one day. I went to go get my car, it was gone. Chris and I had probably lost 10 pounds in a week because the hours we were working were brutal. And Grace was very eccentric. And when we didn't know, but when they hired her, she came with a little bit of a drug problem. So we had troubles getting her out of the trailer. At the time, it's not her fault. Everybody was doing ecstasy at the time. Everybody was experimenting with shit. I mean, so, but she decided to, well, because she's a rock and roller. That's what they do. You know, rock and rollers, and, you know, it's a little different than when you're doing a movie. So she had an entourage around that were partying with her, which were brilliant. Keith's hair, I'm not saying he was, but I don't know around her, but
Right, I know that. Yeah, well, yeah, like we can cut this if I do the research and it's wrong, but I had heard that Keith Haring was indeed into,
it's not his fault. Everybody
right.
was. I mean,
Everybody was doing it. Yeah.
everybody was. I'd have drivers come pick me up to go do a film, and they were higher than kite on cocaine, saying, "Hey, you want a bump?" I'm like, "I'm good, thank you. I want to go to work." But it was just the 80s. It was out of control. There was no being accountable. We didn't have, like, there was no way to find out anybody was doing anything unless you were right in front of them. And I don't even think we didn't even have drug tests back then. You'd have to be right in front of them and say, "You're high on cocaine." I mean, and then how would you prove that, right? So it was just a whole different time. But Grace was very eccentric, amazing woman, actually. And so we had trouble getting around the trailer a lot of the times. So Chris Makepeace and I were constantly doing scenes we weren't prepared for. Richard was like, "We got to go," because the bonding company who gave us the money for the film was threatening to take the film away if we didn't continue to get enough footage in the can, which means you keep shooting all day long. We need 12-hour days. Back then, it was not digital, my friend. It was film. Film was expensive. There was no going back over film. It was like an old-fashioned camera. You take a picture and that's it. You know? So it's called burning film. So it's expensive and the whole thing. So we were, so you never wanted to fuck up in front of the camera because you were burning money, basically.
Money, yeah.
We were thrown in front of the camera a lot, doing scenes we weren't prepared for. So Chris and I were on our feet constantly. Grace would run on the set. She was always saying, "Where's my vibrator? Where's my vibrator?" And we were like, "Wow, okay, I don't know how to answer that." And then one day she ran on the set with her vibrator, flying in the with the cord hanging, going, "Here's my vibrator." And she crashed into the sound cart. I heard her, the vibrator, and the sound man, and the sound cart all went down, vibrator hanging up. I wasn't there that day. I can't confirm that, but I heard the story. Knowing what I know, I'm going to say probably that probably happened. Robert and his brother, Robert, I'll let him tell you the story. You really have to interview him. He has a whole different version of all this.
Oh, I love. I see. I was funny because I heard an interview with him talking about recovery too, and I was like, I've
Oh,
got to
he's in
get him on.
recovery. You bet he is. Did he tell you about him and Grace having a little?
No. I like I said, I haven't heard. Like I said,
Robert.
yeah.
Okay, I don't care. He can get over it. We couldn't find him one day. We needed him on the set. We had to call him in early. No one could find him. And then we couldn't, and meanwhile, they couldn't get Grace out of her house. So the producer, not Richard, but another one, went to her house, knocked on the door, and said, "Grace, we need you on the set." She goes, "Oh, okay." So she left the door open and went to go get ready. And then they saw Robert. And said, "You, we need you on the set as well. We've been trying to get a hold of you." Get Remember, these are back in the days of leaving messages on people's phones.
Right, no cell phones, right?
No cell phone, no computer, maybe a pager, maybe if you were one of those people, right? So we couldn't get a hold of anybody. So you had to physically get in your car and go knock on their door and hope that they were there. So the producer grabbed both of them, threw them on the set. We had sidewalks cave in. The tow truck scene driving down the sidewalk. Sidewalk caved in. We had it just goes on and on. And my wardrobe started falling off of me because I was losing so much weight from living off of cigarettes, peanut M&Ms, and yes, wine at the end of the work day, which was 6 in the morning because we'd work all night, right? So drinking basically early in the morning, then going to sleep during the day, and then doing it all over again. This was when I was drinking. So let's see. You really have to research and find the making of Vamp, because it's actually funny as hell to talk about it afterwards. During at the time, There was concerns, but yet Richard Wang kept the tempo on the film hysterical.
Oh,
No matter
that's cool.
what, he was always laughing shit off to keep all of our spirits up, including when Grace came out on stage as what was written one of the most beautiful, sexy, erotic, strip tease dances anyone's ever seen, that she stuns the room. Well, no one got to see her costumes before she came out. Even nobody got to see it until she came out. When she came out, everybody was stunned, all right? They were speechless, but not because of what was written in the script, but because they were like, what? Richard shot the audience with that reaction because it was so funny.
It
And then
is the best reaction
oh
too,
my,
because it they look like they are just
all went
stunned at what they just watched.
with a coil on one nipple, another coil on another nipple, and then a coil on her coochie, one on the base of the top of her butt crack, and then a coil on her fingers, and I think she had a coil on her neck. The rest was all body paint, Keith Haring. So we were like, this back then, that was now it's not racy. People show up to the fucking Oscars naked. But like at the time, we were like, huh? What? Where's her costume? Wait, what? Is that body paint?
Oh,
But
that's
it turned
amazing.
out to be iconic because everything about that film was kind of the first of its time at the time.
Yeah, because it is such a it is it's almost like a horror movie crossed with After Hours, right? It's very,
Absolutely. And the way
yeah.
Richard shot it was different. He, every time that the people that were not alive came on, it was a blue light. And those of us who were alive, there was more of a pinky light. That had filmmaking hadn't been done yet. So it also had the element of, which people don't realize, but when you watch the film to this day, it still stands on its own
Oh, yeah.
because what he did was so brilliant. And at that time, the first of the black comedy aspect, he really nailed that down because just everybody, Billy Drago, Sandy Baron, Chris Makepeace, Robert, Getty Watanabe, oh my God, just
Oh.
Getty. I freaking love him, man. He improved a lot of that. I'm in the mood for love simply because they're
You're
naked.
naked.
You're just like, how do you come with this stuff? Yeah, it was great. The 80s were fun. I used to think they were tough, but now looking back, they really weren't.
So the first time I ever saw you was specifically in the all-nighter as Valerie Ann O'Herlihy, because I've seen that movie way too many times. And I love it. It's funny because I had to get a special DVD for my sister for her birthday, because I was like, because she really wanted it, and I found it for her and got it to her, and she was like, oh my God, and everyone was like, what is that? And I was like, that's a movie we watched as kids, So, but we love it. And I watched it this morning, and my boyfriend was walking by, and there was like a scene where Brad is talking about himself in the third person, right? And he says, Bradley has a better idea. And my boyfriend, without missing a beat, goes, Bradley should stop talking about himself in the third person. But it was so much fun to watch it. It with like 45-year-old eyes. I was just like, I don't give a shit. It still holds up. It's still a cute, fun. It's not gonna cure cancer. It's not that kind of movie,
Fun, just kind of check out. Kind of like
Yeah.
you go on a wild ride at amusement park. You just get on there, buckle in, and you just go. And then you go on the journey. And then when you unbuckle, you get off and you go, that was fun. That's the all-nighter.
Yeah, it was like a really fun extended music video, because it has this amazing soundtrack, and Susanna Hoffs, you, everybody, it's just fun. I love it. What how did you how did was that just a regular, like, you answered an ad in drama log kind of thing, or did you know Tamar Hoffs before you
I
went in
had,
and
just like kind of doing right now, girl. I audition pretty much for anything and everything, really, unless it doesn't make sense. There was a time because I'm a single mother of two boys. There was a point where I was making money to pay my babysitter to watch both my boys, and so my babysitter was making more money than me. I wasn't around for my boys. And there was a time where I had to say, hey, hold on. This is when I put a pause on and went to college so I could at least spend more time with my boys. But anyways, I auditioned and I got it. And I got to tell you, I am so grateful to have gotten earn every job, whether it was an offer or not. A few times I was actually offered a film, which is always so flattering for me. I'm still very, very, after I started in 82, and now what is this, 2025? Yeah. I'm still very humbled and grateful looking back at my body of work and everyone I had the opportunity to work for and with. The All-Nighter, I will say, is such a special film. I can't tell you how many people say that. They go, oh my God, my favorite film is, well, I'm not sure if it's Vamp or The All-Nighter. And then there are those who go way back. And what's that other? Well, they love the Supernatural one. The Supernatural fans are crazy. I love them. They are nuts. Like, because when I was doing Big Sky, Jensen from Supernatural started, was one in the third season. Oh my God. What's crazy is that because he's one of the two brothers on Supernatural, he was on our show and Big Sky. And then when he came on the set, I completely had forgotten what I had even done on Supernatural. I was on it as a guest star. But I remember biting one of the two boys and I bit their face or something. I was evil. So I we came. I go, Dee Dee, I go, hey, Jensen, how are you? I go, wait a minute, did I bite your face or the other actor's face? He goes, no, you bit my brother's face, and then I blew your head off. And then you had demon babies, and you're probably one of the most popular characters on Supernatural because you gave demon babies. I said, oh, really? So I was really like kind of cool. And he goes, yeah. I said, oh, that's crazy. Look at me. I had no idea. Well, since he went on Big Sky, I got 1,000 more followers. Because now all of a sudden I'm like, but it gets better. One of our followers, and this is what I love about my followers and his followers, and just anybody who appreciates my work. One of them said, Dee Dee on my Instagram, don't you remember? You and Jensen were on Sybil together. And they gave me a screenshot. I know, right? I just saw your face. There's a screenshot of me looking, well, 12, and him looking 11 on Sybil. And I went,
Oh,
oh my God, I ran to work that day. I said, Jensen, look. And he goes, wait a minute, that's you. I go, I know, and that's you. He goes, oh, we worked together before Supernatural. We had completely forgotten. He had just showed up to Hollywood when he did Sybil. It was
wow.
a guest starring role. And I don't remember really anything. I don't remember what I did for Brett earlier today. So our fans said, this is your third time working together. Isn't that crazy? We didn't even remember, but our fans remembered. So there you go.
That's so awesome. What was the shoot like with the All-Nighter? Because I mean, you guys are on the beach
Yep,
like all the time.
all the time. It was at first we kind of wore our makeup darker because of the tan element. Eventually, we did not have to do that because we started getting real tan. Sunscreen. I'm not sure what we were using for sunscreen if we were using any back then. It was really fun. I became really close at that time with Joan Cusack. Joni and I, when I first moved, when she came to LA to do the film, she came with at that time her boyfriend, and they were living in an apartment. And it was something happened, I'm not sure what, but she was starting to look for another place. And I said, oh, that's crazy. You can live with me. So I literally went over with just her suitcase and a bunch of trash bags, moved her out, and moved her in with me. I had a bachelor, not even a single. It was a room, the hot plate, and like a toilet or bathroom. She moved in with me. And we slept in the same bed because I literally had, I don't think I had a couch. And so we lived together during the making of that. And we were just like freaking frack. We were freak, oh my God, we had way too much fun together. I ended up dating Lewis from the band Lewis and Clark that was played on the beach. He was the very handsome guitar player who was
Oh, okay.
Susanna Hoff's ex-boyfriend at the time.
Oh.
Susanna started dating the lead guy, John, the blonde guy, right?
Oh, John. Oh, wait. Okay, so wait. John Terlesky, as
And
in the. Oh.
she started dating him. I don't know if Lewis flirted with me or I flirted with him, but all of a sudden I was like, oh, okay, well, he's free. This is how horrible we all were. I was like, well, he's free. Who cared that it was the lead girl's ex-boyfriend? I'm like, well, they're not dating. That's different. So I started dating him. She was pissed, but I'm like, dude, you're messing around with John. What are you? You're right. And Joni Cusack is like, I ain't nothing to do with this. Yeah, because she had just got out of a really turbulent relationship, or a dysfunctional. She was like, no. I'm just here to do a movie and party and have a good time, right? And there was that. So I dated Lewis for a long time. Actually, moved in together after the movie, and then Then of course as that didn't work out. But like what else? What else? My, there's, oh, the scene in the jail when the girl who the junkie. Well, I think they, I think I can talk about this. The girl that they hired, I believe actually was had issues with substance, I believe.
Oh.
Or one of the most amazing method actors I've
I was
ever.
gonna say she's a really good actress, if that's, you know what I mean? Like either because she seemed very, like she even says it in in the jail cell. She's like, I'm strung out.
I think there was a time where people were casting the real people for actors. You know what I mean? Where you're supposed to like, and I'm pretty sure that that may have been an issue because I remember when I was supposed to, the whole slapping or hitting each other, whatever that was a problem. Yeah, we had, because I'm going to say this with love, that she wasn't familiar with what a stunt meant.
Right. A stunt hit or slap versus, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember, yeah, that was a challenging scene, and I remember going, oh. And again, though, then this is not uncommon at the time, though. I had worked with a lot of people who I thought, wait a minute, they're not acting. What? What else about the all-nighter? What do you want to know about the all-nighter? What else?
So the fashion in it, I love your outfit, how you have the little orange suspenders, and you have these amazing, you have so many different types of sunglasses in it. Like you have these really cool purple sunglasses that just kind of like they pull off like this, and you have, the ones with the checkerboards, all that stuff. Like I live for that stuff. I really love that stuff so much because it's just so interesting to me with like the brightly, like the yellow earrings and all that. So, did you guys see, a lot of the people that I interview or a lot of the movies that I tend to showcase on the show are B movies, right? And so people do indeed wear their own clothes. So was that just like, hey, this is wardrobe today kind of thing, or?
The wardrobe, and I apologize, my memory's so bad. I
That's
can't.
okay.
Well, whoever she, he, they were, and I say that because I'm not sure. Fantastic. That was all wardrobe. None of that was mine, which is rare because usually I bring some of my own wardrobe in because there's a piece that I wore on the interview that reminded me of that character that I will bring and say, hey, I wore this on the interview. Can we incorporate it? That happens three, maybe four out of five times. There's this one watch that I wear all the time that I have worn since Red Surf with George Clooney.
Oh,
That was
wow.
80s. And I wore it up until I think Big Sky. And there's these people who, God bless them, follow me, said, she's been wearing, someone goes, oh, I love that watch. And this other person clicks in, oh, she's been wearing that since 19, da da da, with George Clooney and Red Surf. She's wore it and drilled off all of the things that I wore that watch in. And I said, damn, girl, you got better memory than me. I had no memory. I knew I wore it a few times. Oh, she named everything that I wore it in. I said, and I, of course, respond, because it's that cool. I have bringing it back, you don't bring back something that's not cool. So there are times I do wear my own wardrobe, absolutely. But that particular movie, that was all the wardrobe coordinator and designer. Oh my God, just fantastic. Just what I love is that it represented who Val really was.
Yes, that's why I love her because she's funny, she's quirky, she's adorable in the way she speaks, and her and Killer are my two favorite characters in that movie because Killer speaks in, broken philosophy and also like a truncated version of English, like
Right.
where he cuts off certain words and he's like, ex lasagna mall, it's like, 'cause it's that much harder to say the word Molly or excellent, apparently. I live for the fact that that movie is so unique. And I like the fact that it's different than the 80s movies that had around that time. And I have a bizarre fascination with 1980s California culture, and films that are shot in that time period. So I will ask you, and if you remember, great. And if you don't, it's
Yeah,
totally
right.
not right. But like, do you remember what the shooting locations were for that? Like the college, the hotel, and then that little tiny house on the beach.
The beaches were Leo Creole, up northern, north from LA. And actually, my little sister and I, and my older sister, Shell, Lori, I have two sisters. We have this thing. We're not allowed to say, "Do you remember dot, dot, dot?" Because we got rid of that in our vocabulary. Because the older we get, the answer is no.
No.
Horrible, because you're like, why did I just forget that entire part of that 10 years of my life? So now we have to say, there was a time when we were younger, but I hit you in the face with my sandal. And then you wait. And the other one goes, "Oh, I did." And you go, and then that's the cue. "I don't remember doing that." Or, "Oh, I remember that." You don't want to make the other one feel bad for saying, "You don't remember hitting me in the face with sandal when we were 3 and 4?" No, I really don't. Leo Carrier was a beach. The hotel was right there in Santa Monica. It's a tall one. I want to say Holiday Inn, I think.
Oh, really? Okay.
If you go in Santa Monica, one, maybe two streets from the beach, tall, tall, tall. I can't remember the cross. I want to say not second, but it's a hotel there in Santa Monica. Now the college, that's a, I don't even remember that.
That's what I was wondering, was it was because it kind of looked like USC. But then I was sort of like, well, I get because it's called Pacifica, which is not a real place. So
That's a good question. Where do, I don't remember, but I know that the interior of the apartment was on a studio lot, and I want to say, oh God, it was one of the studio lots. Because I remember Jamie and I were late for school. I mean, oh my God, there's a slip. Late for filming one day. And I remember it was, our alarm didn't go off because we were up all the whole night just around. And we were both in the scene. Oh my God, they were calling us left and right, and we were bad, bad girls. So we jumped in the car like crazy, and we ran to the set. And I remember the set being, I was in Hollywood at the time, and it was way across town. So I want to say Sony or somewhere way across town.
so the interior of the house is a set, and then the outside is just an actual house.
Yeah, that they generally do that. Yeah, they'll do like an exterior. They'll just give somebody some money to shoot the exterior of their house, and then they do interiors.
Man, because I love that house. I was like, oh, how cool. They all live in the same house on the beach. That must have been so neat, right? And then I'm like, yeah,
Girl.
it's a set, right? All right. So changing gears. You took some time off, and is that when you decided that you were going to get sober? Or when did you know personally, this is a problem for me, something's got to give?
From the get-go,
Okay.
I never drank like the way my friends did in high school. I was, well, first of all, one of the things that I loved about recovery, when I went to rehab, an extensive inpatient 30-day rehab where I didn't have a phone, computer, nothing. I didn't see my family, my boys, which was very hard for a single parent. But I knew my family was taking care of my children and my animals. But let me tell you, when I went in there broken, when I heard somebody in my, they call them community in the rehab, somebody say, "I never fit in." Bawling. I went, "Oh my God, I found my people. I have never fit in." And I think there's a lot of elements as to why I never fit in. And that certainly is part of the drinking. The other part of that is that it's in my DNA. My father was an alcoholic. It runs on both sides of the family. So it's certainly in my DNA. But I also think it's societal in the sense that, that's what you used to steal my dad's beer in a campsite, blah, blah, blah. But I never drank the way everybody else drank. And somewhere, even though I didn't even know what alcoholism was, or nor that it was a disease, nor that it was a problem. I mean, remember, I grew up in a generation where you're like, "Ah, that's just Bob. He drank too much tonight, whatever." And everybody's cleared out of the room, picked up the damage the next day, and went on with your life. That was it. No one talked about the elephant in the room. Or if you did, it was, he had too much to drink, and that was it. As if, like, oh, he had too much pie and he threw up. Like, no, that's not a good, So now, through all those years, I'm going to say I always had issues. I think everybody who has an issue with something like I said, whether it's sex, gambling, drugs, alcohol, or whatever that you're using to an extent, using to an extent that it is disrupting your life in a way that's not positive, could possibly be an addiction or not. I'm not going to loop everything into that. But if it's certainly something to look at twice, is this an addition or a subtraction to my life that I'm in the gym 12 out of 24 hours a day, or that I have to have sex or food or drugs, or why do I have to finish the bottle of wine? Why can't, like, my other friends leave a half a beer at the table? And I'm like, oh, hell no, we don't. That's happy hour, man. That, we don't leave. I never could understand anybody who could leave a glass of wine.
Like an alcoholic beverage of any kind, or like, oh no, like we just that's enough cocaine for me. Like, what do you
Only
mean?
one shot of heroin or what, not another two or what, you know what I mean? Yeah, only one shot of meth or whatever, however they take that. Yeah, like you just, that's right. So what happened was, it's like everybody, I was a very high functioning, a very functioning alcoholic until I wasn't. Until I wasn't. It started to slowly just eat at the very core of, I'm going to say, my authentic self. Just no more denying it. And I was after, oh no, I took time off to go to school because, like I said, the industry had changed so dramatically that I was working to pay the babysitter to raise my kids. And I was like, something's wrong here. And I thought, and I wanted to help people. I knew that I've always volunteered for animals or people or what have you, always. So I decided, hey, maybe I want to go, maybe I'll get a degree, take a break from the industry that's I'm so loyal to. I was so loyal to the industry. It wasn't so loyal back to me anymore. And things had changed to the point where I didn't really like the way things were changing. I didn't like the way women were being treated or cast or what have you. And there was a big lopsided, and I'm raising two boys. And I thought, I need to take a break from this. So I went into college not knowing what the hell I was doing. I had a learning disorder. I had no idea I had that. I did not know what to do. I walked up Pierce College in LA. And I said, hi, I want to help people. I want to get a degree. And they said, well, what degree? I said, I don't know. And they're like, what do you, ma'am, no, what degree do you want to get? I said, I don't know. You tell me. And they're like, no, that's not the way this works. You tell me what degree you want, and I'm going to help you set, make that happen. I said, I just want to help people. And then they go, you mean like a psychiatrist or psychologist? I said, yeah, that works. So he just threw me in a class, a child development class. And it started from there. I learned I had a learning disability. I started testing in the disabilities office, game changer. Went from possibly a failing student to an A student,
That's amazing.
discovering I had a learning disability. And once addressed, my academia just changed. Raising my two kids on my own with the monkey on my back, with the addiction still there. Because again, high functioning, my father was one of the most, I'm going to say most high functioning, but not really, because he never went higher than where he could go with his addiction, because a lot of people do this, where they're high functioning alcoholics or high functioning meth heads or whatever. When you're a high functioning addict, you only get to a certain point. You can't grow any further than that, or you start to go south. I started to go south, where after my first year of my graduate program in UCLA, I was in break, about to start my last year, finally. 10 years later, right? And my family came to me and said, we want to do an intervention. I said, oh my God, you don't have to. I wrote down a number the other night from an ad on my TV that said 1-800 addiction number anonymously, and we can help you. I wrote it down. I just didn't have the courage to call it. I didn't know how to ask for help. This is one reason why I'm recovering out loud, and I could cry right now, because so many people like me are afraid to ask for help because there's so much stigma around this disease. Nobody wakes up and says, hey, I want to be an addict. That sounds like fun. Nobody wants to be an addicted to anything that keeps you from your authentic self. It's just not the way it is. Does our behavior act like we want it? Sure, because the addict inside of you is horrendous and takes no fucking prisoners and will tear you down and out, your children, your family, everyone loves you around down with it. If one doesn't remove that fear and say, no more Felicia. We're done.
Yeah, and it tells you, addiction tells you you need it. It tells you, I mean, I was under the impression, number one, that I couldn't write without it, that I couldn't create without it, that I wasn't as much fun without it, that, you know, I was much more interesting, I was much more outgoing without it. All false. All completely false, because you know, I operate so much better when I'm not, you know, in it, right? I mean, like when I'm not, okay, all right, so I gotta wake up and now, oh, okay, well, where's my this? Okay, well, I have to take this because I have to go to work. Okay, great. So I function, 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 function. Okay, oh, shit, gotta go to bed. Well, what am I gonna take for that? Okay, I have to take this. Okay, oh, shit, I hope I didn't run out, you know, okay, I got a plan, right? It's exhausting.
That's the addict inside driving the car, driving your car is what I'm right now. I'm driving my car. You are driving your car. What happens is, and this is where prelapse signs we have to be careful of. Right now, my addict is still in the car, but she's in the trunk.
That's good. Yeah.
The trunk. I'm
Right.
driving this motherfucking car, and she's in the trunk. Now she has a little bed. She's fine. I thanked her for trying to help me, but I got it now, bitch. Just stay back there. You're fine. But what happens is every once in a while, when we're driving our car, especially when I drive by a happy hour, that bitch jumps out of that trunk into my back seat of my car and starts tapping me on the shoulder. Hey, let me drive just once. Just once, let me drive. And there, that's a prelapse sign. And that's when you have to pull that car over and say, oh, I'm sorry, excuse me. Excuse me, ma'am. I'm going to take your hand, thank you, but no thank you, and put you back in the trunk, get back in that car, pat yourself on the shoulder, and continue driving your car. Because here's the thing, the addict drives our car. We're going to eventually just crash into a fucking wall, and that's the end of it. And that's how I like to describe, because here's the thing, that part of you, the addict part of you, is actually trying to survive in the only way that it knows. It's called the firefighter in you. The firefighter comes out, and how the firefighter, here's like a little flame, right? Something that might make you want to relapse. It's like a little teeny thing that, but it's like a trigger. The firefighter will come out with a fucking hose and blow it out of the room with a hose, which is called relapse. Where when really what you might need is to look at the little flame. And maybe just do this. You know what?
All you need to do.
That could be a phone call to somebody. That could be writing. That could be jumping up and down. That could be doing push-ups. That could mean go outside, walk around, take your shoes off, put your feet in Mother Earth. I don't know how you deal with your triggers, but find your way. And mine are different. They change every day. But just throw yourself out of that mindset, because that's you rewinding, and some would say undoing the steps. I say you're right. I say it's the addict jumping in the back seat, tapping you on the shoulder. And that's when you have to say, no, don't give up that steering wheel.
Yeah, and it's, you know, like you had talked, you had said, you know, it's like, oh, you have, you know, almost 17 years. Like there's that idea, I think, with that people are like, oh, well, you must have it, you know. I think most people who are not in a 12-step program would feel like, oh, she's fine, right? Like she's got, but if it's just the right amount of tapping, right? Or it's the right tap or the wrong tap that it takes for if I am compromised in any way, maybe I'm sick, maybe I'm tired, maybe I'm hungry, maybe I just had a breakup, a job loss, halt. Yeah, hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Yeah, exactly. If any of those things, and it's just the right moment, somebody tapping me on the shoulder is like I quit a job because I saw my drug of choice. Like somebody had my literal drug of choice sitting right next to my cubicle, and I went, you know, like, and I think I had, fuck, I think I had I 2 years, maybe 1 year, 18 months, something like that, and I was just like, oh my God, you know. And so I was just like, yeah, I'm out. Sorry, I can't. That is a very specific drug of choice that is there's this this is a sign that I am not supposed to be here. And I was, like I said, you're early in recovery. Everything is catastrophic. Everything is just, you know.
Learning how to live again
Yes.
that without the firefighter, without the act coming in and blowing everything up with a fucking fire hose. And it's like you're on your own putting out your own fires now.
Oh.
You have to become very, and by the way, you can do it. I promise you right now, if a little teeny fire just started on your desk, you wouldn't just run. I would hope you wouldn't just run and go, ah, and let the building run down. You would take something and smack it down or blow it out. It might be, right?
Right,
If it's
use the
small,
tools, right? You would use the tools, like whatever tool you have in your toolbox.
blanket near your kitchen, which I have a fire blanket that you pull and you throw it over the fire. It's right, it's pr being prepared. So, right, you're not prepared if the fire happens and then you think, oh, I should have gotten a fire blanket. That's a little, you're behind the eight ball, right? So, if you know that you're in recovery, you know that you get triggered. And by the way, I would in halt, hungry, angry, lonely, tired, I would add G halt and grief.
Oh yeah, grief is, oh my God.
And we throw grief away like, oh, everybody grieves when you have a loss. This is true, but I did my thesis, my college thesis, my friend's a grief therapist, specialist. Grief is a tricky one, and not everybody handles grief the same. And there's different levels of grief. And just like everything else, it's normal to grieve. And if we can somehow remember that grief is love that has nowhere to go. So when I just lost, we just lost one of our dogs, I immediately put a plant where she likes to lay because where she laid, there was this void of energy. You bet, right? 100 pound Rottweiler. Are you kidding me? That was, and she was the queen. So we put her ashes, I put my mala beads, I put her collar and then a plant right where she is. Now when we walk by, it's still sad, but the plant creates a vibration and energy around where her energy used to be. And then my son left for college. So I had to put some energy where his piano used to be. So now I have all these plants where his piano used to be. And so when you're aware of, see, these are all triggers. How about wanting to smoke a cigarette or drink a drink? One of the two of those, if not both of those compounded, could have easily made me go out. But again, I just viewed my sobriety as a little baby, little fragile baby that I have to take care of. And if that means laying in the bed all day and crying, guess what? If you don't use, meaning you don't use your drug of choice, whatever that might be, you're still ahead of the game. Even if you didn't do anything that day but lay in bed and cry, you are still winning, my friend, because you didn't use. I'm sorry, my friend calls it showing up. Did you show up? I said, what are you talking about? I didn't do anything other than lay in bed and cry. They go, did you use? I go, no. And they go, then you showed up and
Then you showed up.
you showed up because when you showed up for yourself, because you could have went and got a bottle of booze, but you didn't. You could have went and got a pack of cigarettes, but you didn't. You fucking showed up. No, you didn't do the dishes. No, you didn't wipe your ass that day. No, you didn't eat that day. Or yeah, you ate a whole 5,000 gallons of ice cream and you cried. But did you use? No. Then you showed up. And guess what? You're still in the game, and tomorrow you can start over again. I was like, thank you for that gift of wisdom, because there's some days that's all I can do is just show up. And that's enough. That's enough. That's enough.
Oh, God. Oh my God, I'm getting old. It's so amazing. Like I love that recovery. It's like a language, right? It's like a language that we speak, and then there's this unity, you know, that connects us
Don't
in
you
this.
pick up what I dropped. I know
Yes.
you got it. My son's probably listening to this going, God, she talks a lot. Isn't she done with this already? Because he's not an addict. He doesn't have any issues with that,
And I totally relate to the grief thing because when I lost my dad, who was also an alcoholic, like, I mean, it's in my DNA, trust me. I didn't use, like, I wasn't using actively, but what I did start to do was a thing that I did as a kid, which was binge eat. And I started just binge eating, binge eating, binge eating. In fact, the majority of my inheritance was spent on takeout food, like just. That was what I did. And then it was when I realized I was like, this is not, you know, like I, in my, you know, whatever I said, I need grief counseling. And then I got into grief counseling, and then all of a sudden the binge eating stopped, right? Because I have an outlet for my feelings. I'm able to talk about my dad. And my dad was a renowned OBGYN, and he had delivered over 6,000 babies. So I had two grieving processes. I had to grieve his public persona, the people that knew him as Dr. Gilmer, and oh yes, he delivered all of our children, and oh, he stayed with me when I was sick, and and then the dad, which is the alcoholic, manic depressive, disassociated, emotionally unavailable, what he did the best that he could with what tools he had because he is a completely different generation, right? So I had two grief processes where I had to grieve both of those things, and it was long and involved, and I had to ask for help for it because,
Good for you. Again, why do we have issues asking for help? Once again, we as human beings in this lifetime are just covered and layered with a lot of misinformation. Okay? Asking for help is not weak. Whatever jackass said that is wrong. And if they want to eat, go ahead on my Instagram and yell at me for saying that. I don't give a shit because you're wrong. Asking for help takes balls. I am sorry. Asking for help takes courage. And asking for help says, I want to live. I want to be happy. I want to be okay. And I don't know how to do that. My God, like I always tell my boys, there's learning mistakes. If you're in school and you fail in math, you're not stupid. You just math is not your thing, number one. Maybe you need a tutor, number two, right? And if you knew all the answers, you'd be teaching the class. On, right? So let's address what's going on. Maybe we need to make math more interesting. I don't know, right? But you're not stupid, and it's not like, so you ask for help. Let's think out of the box, right? So and the thing with addiction is that and anything to do with this, if you and mental health, it's the same fucking thing. Mental health is so stigmatized by, and again, this, you know what this is? Old information. Still with it. We're living in a time, by the way, where the earth is changing and people are changing. Everything, if you think about it, look around you in the world, not just our country, but the world, things are changing. Old ways of thinking are changing, are breaking. Things are shifting. We're not going to go back to the way we used to be. That's done. I'm not sure where we're going, but I know where we were is over. And part of that is the old thinking. This is why people are coming out and recovering out loud. You know what I mean? And they're saying, hey, get over yourself. Okay, I had an issue with A, B, or C, but now I'm living proof that one can lean into it and live a happier life. Because we're so, for some reason, we've been taught that it's not to get close to our authentic self, that we need to be this image of ourselves or an image of what other people think we should be versus who you really fucking are.
Yeah, 'cause when
False.
I think when I got five, I think I had 5 years. I had 5 years, and then I had a breakdown because I was involved in a really abusive relationship, and the person that I was involved with isolated me from recovery, friends, sponsors, sponsees, whatever. So I got out, but I started because of the abuse, my body just shut down completely, and I just was I my mom found me sobbing and just rocking back and forth, and she said, "Do you need to go to the hospital?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And they said, "Do you think you would kill yourself?" And I said, "Yes, I would absolutely kill myself if I had the opportunity." So then they committed me, and while I was there, they were like, "You're bipolar." And I was like, "No." Like, I can deal with being an addict. I can deal with being an alcoholic. I can deal with whatever. I said, no, I know those people, and no, and just very much a no, right? And I, at the time that I was diagnosed, it wasn't about, rah-rah mental health at all. It was not, that was a bad word. That was a word that was used to describe, like, oh, my girlfriend texted me 17 times. Like, she's bipolar. The weather is bipolar. Like, it was used as a punchline. So I was all by myself and didn't really, it was pretty much, the doctors were like, here's some meds. go, you know.
Well, it's not
So,
going to go away.
right. So then I found a therapist who was also in recovery, and he was like, you know, there's a holistic healing element to having this particular mental illness. Like, you understand that you're going to have to view everything that you consume, whether it's television, whether it's people, whether it's energy, whether it's whatever, because now it is not just about you taking meds and going to therapy. This is about exercise, nutrition, vitamins, sunlight, nature, friendship, support. You know, he's like, there's going to be a whole other group of things that you're going to have to keep an eye on that are going to affect whether you are mentally healthy, whether you are manic or whether you are depressive. He's like, and I don't want you manic or depressive. I want you right here in the middle. So I had to learn that, like, I can't drink caffeine after 12. I have to go to bed at a certain time. I don't really eat sugar, you know, because it disrupts everything. Like, and of course, now I'm 45, so perimenopause. So now it's like, oh, sleep. Yeah, you gotta have a whole routine for that. Like, that's not so that was like second stage recovery stuff where it was like, oh, great. You know, like, I have to deal with this, right? But now I am so open about it that it then helped other people, and other people have come to me and been like, I am also bipolar. Like, I really love that you share your story about that and share that there's hope and that it's not a death sentence and that it's not a suicide march and that you know, just like the We Do Recover stuff. It's like, yeah, I mean, I do maintain my mental health now after, you know, like a decade of making mistakes and trying this medicine and trying that medicine and, you know, just not understanding, right? You know, so it's like it's experimentation, you know. So, yeah. And it was just like, but it was a fear when I got diagnosed, because I was like, oh, I don't want to have that fucking stigma attached. Like, I'm totally fine being a, you know, recovering drunk and recovering, you know, addict, I said, but oh, don't put that on me, you know.
Right, exactly.
In closing, if you could say anything right now to, because I do have a lot of people in recovery who listen to the show, and I have a lot of people who reach out to us as fans and everything, and especially look up to you know, in your recovery journey. Like, what could you say right now about, like, just not giving up before the miracle happens, you know?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on your podcast to be able to reach even one person and at the minimum plant the seed and run. If anything else comes from it, great. But really, one of the reasons why I'm recovering out loud is if anything, just to get people thinking, you know, huh? Something she said resonated with me. So I'm going to leave you with a few things that Kathleen Murphy at the rehab that I went to gave me as I call zingers and gifts. And I want to share. Oh, hello, Mo. That's my cat. Not my cat, my son's cat. But he now moves, so now it's my cat. Welcome, say hi. He's a huge Maine Coon. So what it is, first of all, for those around people who are active in their disease, which is what it is. It's an appropriate way of saying it. I think calling names and calling people you're a drunk, you're an out, you're a drug user, you're an addict is not helpful.
No.
It's
No.
really painful, and all you're going to do is shove that person even further away into the corner, and then the addict comes out with the fire hose and says, "Oh, we can take care of this pain because that was hurt that they called you that. Let's just go drink that off or whatever, right?" That firefighter, you're just asking that firefighter to come out and put that put that pain out. Only way that it knows. It's not helpful. Now, something else I would say is maybe if you don't know of a rehab around you, that's okay. No one's asking you to do that. But maybe say to that person, "I can see that you really have a hard time And I'm really sorry. I love you. If there's any way that I can help you, let me know. Period. Just, and if they say, let them come to the place and the awareness, trust me, they know they have a problem. We know we have a problem. We don't need you telling us. And we certainly don't need you slapping us in the face with that. It's not helpful. So if you have somebody in your life who you see struggling with addiction or relapse over and over again, words of encouragement and love and space. Even saying something like, I have no idea what it must feel like. You're going through what you're going through. I just want to let you know I love you. And if there's anything I can do to help you, let me know. Period. That will break them down. And that firefighter will not come out and put that out. Maybe they, I don't know. Everyone's journey is different. But here's the other part of that. That person, it may not change or seek help just because of that. They will seek help when they're ready. So people say, oh, they just need a different rehab. Oh, they just need this. They just need that. No, they need to be ready. And you can't make them ready until they are ready. It's like losing weight. I'm not going to lose fucking weight until I'm fucking ready to stop eating cookies. Okay. You can say to me all day long, well, maybe if you say, Aditi, you're getting chubby. You know, here's the thing. That might make me start to not eat crap and lose weight. But now I'm doing it because you said that. That's a relapse waiting to happen because I didn't do it because I was tired of my G-string being tight. That's different than you saying you're chubby to me, right? Two different ways. When I say I'm sick and tired of my G-string working as fucking floss versus under. Stop or cut down on the fucking cookies, right? And then your mission and your journey looks different than because somebody else said it, right? So that's certainly something for those around us. For those in it, remember that there's nothing wrong with you. You have a disease. Any more than there's anything wrong with somebody with cancer. It's a disease. They did not wake up asking for cancer. You did not wake up asking for an addiction. Period. Society sometimes is not going to be kind to you, but there is support out there when you're ready and not a minute before then. So just think about it and know when you're ready, we're out there, we're out here. We're out here, okay? And AA is not the only way to get sober. A lot of people are using other ways to get sober. There's a new generation of kids are just choosing not to drink. They're not saying I have a problem, like, or my son said, Mama, I said, listen, you have to be careful. There's runs in our family. And he said, No, we don't go there. I said, excuse me. He goes, no, I choose not to drink. I just don't drink. And there's this whole wave of younger kids who are just choosing not to be to do mind-altering things. That they're interested in who they really are as authentic people versus the one that's medicated or altered. And I'm like, you, dude, because he didn't like the way I said that you're a child and not a parent. And, you know, that did not resonate with him. So do be careful if you are somebody and you might say, well, it runs in our family. Be careful of that. People are getting away from labels. And because labels are not helpful, especially when there's stigma, like you said, bipolar. Oh my God, she's crazy. No, she has regulating her emotions, period. No one said anything about crazy. By the way, I'm as crazy as a fucking bat, and I love crazy. Insane. So be careful when you throw the word crazy around. And I'm going to say one last thing. When you're active in your disease, it's easy to be considered the identified problem. But guess what happens the minute you choose to change? You become the identified possibility.
I
So that,
love that.
right? The identified problem is the person that's still active in their disease, who's struggling and really having troubles. The minute, and you don't need years of recovery to be the identified possibility. You just need the moment you decide, that's it. The buck stops here. I need help and I want to change this. Is the moment you become the identified possibility? Because let me tell you, people around you are going to be threatened. They know deep down inside it takes one badass motherfucker to get sober. It is hard. And there's a good chance there's people around you who you're going to threaten, who also need to maybe look in their backyard, not necessarily with addiction, with alcohol or drugs, but maybe something else is going on. And they see you literally having a rebirth and a new way of living and thinking and feeling. And they're looking at their lives going, wait a minute, I'm not going to take care. Where's my place in this person's life if I'm not their caretaker? Or the person blaming them, you're an alcoholic. You know, if you're not that person anymore, you are going to accidentally redefine people's roles in your life when you change. And not everyone's going to be comfortable with that role change. And that's okay. Leave space for them. Leave space for them to not like it. And they might even want to sabotage you. And again, don't hate on them. Just know that they're uncomfortable with your change because they don't want to change. Not everyone's comfortable with change. And that's okay. Again, that's okay. That's their journey, not yours. You say, bring it on, Felicia. I want the change. And I'm going to leave you with that girl.
Thank you so much for doing this. It's just awesome. Like it exceeded any like expectation I may have had or any fear that I may have had about like, I'm not an interviewer, right? But it just was so amazing, and you just
Thank
touched my
you.
heart. You got me like real excited about recovery again, because
Good.
that's
That's
something.
why I'm doing this. Just, you know, that's why I do it. Thank you. That's a ricochet effect. I did this, I helped you, and then it ricocheted. Now that made me feel like, yeah, I'm jazzed about my recovery because you just said I jazzed you about your recovery. And God knows if someone's listening to this, maybe we jazzed them about their recovery or we got someone thinking about it maybe a little bit. No one's saying nothing. We're just saying it's an option.
I love this so much. All right, guys. Thank you again to Dee Dee Pfeiffer for giving me her time on a Sunday. My goodness. If you guys want to follow us on Instagram, Dee Dee has an Instagram, and she's awesome enough to answer to answer little posts and stuff. So tell the audience where they can find you as well.
Pfeiffer official. And it's because I'm lame and I don't really know how to do like the other ones. I think I don't even know if I have a Facebook. Oh, I do the other one, Threads, because it's attached to
Yeah,
Instagram.
Threads is attached to Instagram. Yeah. Yes, it is.
Bluebird one, the bird blue, oh boy, the bird
Oh,
one.
Blue Sky?
I do have Blue Sky, but I'm terrible about going on there and posting because I can't figure it out. And yeah, so just Instagram, that's where you're going to find me. That's where I'm literally active. One day I'm going to get my shit together and do all the other ones, but I do have TikTok as well. And
Oh.
I don't do X just out of principle.
Yeah,
And
no.
again, no judgment. I just prefer not to. That's all. And I find people, my followers are amazing. I love my followers. I have really beautiful, amazing people who interact with not only with me but with each other, and it's beautiful. I don't have millions, and you know something? I like it that way because I can actually, if I had millions, it'd be really difficult to respond to everybody.
Yeah, I know that's such a that's absolutely so true. I don't know what movie we're doing next time, but as always, stay manic.